Christian view of the environment. I do teach an environmental science class here, so this is something that is significant to me. I have had an environmental concern since high school. Not sure where that came from. That's why I studied ecology at the University of Illinois. Technically, I was a zoology major, but my special area was in ecology. I actually thought that my future would be as a forest ranger. And I was going to have my own little log cabin on the top of a meadowed hill, and well, God had different ideas, and his ideas tend to matter more than ours. So my perspective changed in college, and since apologetics was very significant in my coming to Christ, I thought that might be an area that I'd like to spend some time with, and I only discovered creationist writing when I was a senior in college, and once I found that, I just couldn't stop reading the stuff, and it was clear God wanted me to play some kind of role in that. So that whole park ranger, forest ranger thing just kind of disappeared. I was a part of an environmental group on the Illinois campus. It was called itself the Society for Environmental Concerns, which they chose to abbreviate. I don't see any markers in here. Okay, well.
Oh,
there you go. So it was abbreviated S for students, environmental E, concerns C, the last letter of concerns is S. How would you pronounce that?
Oh,
yeah.
My God. Did they not think that through?
No, it was intentional. It was. Why bother putting the S from the end of the word concerns up there, unless that's what you wanted to do? And the second time I met Sue on the University of Illinois campus, it was on the quad, and I was on the quad selling balloons for sex.
Did you not realize what you were saying?
I knew
exactly. Yeah,
yeah. One of the few times I actually remembered a name and she didn't. I remembered her name, she didn't remember mine. So that usually doesn't happen. Doesn't happen that way, usually. So yeah, this has been something that's been of concern of mine for quite a long time. And so it's been a part of my work at Probe as well, a lesser part than the creation evolution side of things, but a significant one as well. When we developed a mind games track that was science and faith, well, this was one of the presentations I included in that. Calvin DeWitt is a Christian and an ecologist, and he wrote a book many years ago, and he introduced it by talking about seven degradations in nature that can be seen, and I'll comment on some of these as we go. But the first one he talked about was the idea of land being converted, habitats essentially destroyed at an increasing rate. As urban centers grow, they usually encroach upon farmland. Then to recover sufficient farmland to grow their food need, that has to encroach on forest and prairie and other things that have not been developed yet. So there's a process of conversion that seems to always be going on. And that was emphasized by a National Geographic article study that was done on what they called urban sprawl, and just the idea of urban areas growing larger. 1950, 70 million Americans lived in urban areas, 13,000 square miles. By 1990, the urban population had doubled, but the amount of land had quintupled, multiplied by five. So the sprawl was increasing faster than just the population. So we're utilizing more and more space for urban areas. Metropolitan Atlanta covers an area larger than the state of Delaware. That's a lot. That's a big area for one city. Sprawl covers 1.2 million acres of farmland every year. Every year. And since 69, think about this now, the numbers of cars and trucks has increased twice as fast as the population. Does that sound a little weird? In my family growing up, Sue's family growing up, two-car families. That was the extent of it. Any teenage child who lived at home who actually had a car was an extremely rare thing. So now that's no longer the case. You have a family of five in the household, there could be three, four cars per household. So that's how that's been increasing. We're just more mobile, especially in a city like Dallas where public transportation is here, but it's pretty meager. Growing up in Chicago, in the city itself, my high school was 5 miles from my house. I took a bus every day. So one bus 3 miles that way, and then 2 miles that way, and that's just one transfer. It took about a half hour to get that 5 mile distance on a bus, about 5 minutes per mile on average, which is not too bad. But you could get anywhere in that city, from any place else in the city, without much difficulty at all. And that's not the case in Dallas. The public transportation here is meant to get people from the outskirts to downtown, and from downtown back. It doesn't do much else than that. Second one, some people estimate that there's three species becoming extinct every year. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. That's really a guess. We're assuming that we know we're able to name a little over a million species, but because so much of the rainforest is species rich in the first place, and we haven't cataloged the rainforests as clearly as we have temperate areas, they're just kind of assuming there's a lot more species there. And because that land is disappearing faster than any place else, there must be a lot of extinctions happening. So it's really a guesstimate. Land itself, where we do have people living particularly, is being degraded. Some would say because it's an overuse of fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, basically chemicals of various sorts. That's a section we just covered in the environmental science book. Wastes become an increasing problem. There is a full chapter in our environmental science on waste, both urban and agricultural, and how we as a society deal with it. We're not going to run out of landfill space anytime soon. There's really plenty available for that. They will sometimes try to scare you with that. But the big waste that I usually like to mention is from here in the lower corner, and that's radioactive waste from nuclear power plants. And it's not that there is a lot of it, because there isn't, but what there is very, very persistent. Some of these nuclear wastes have to be stored not just for hundreds or thousands, but tens of thousands of years where they won't be disturbed before they're no longer radioactive. That's a level of management that we haven't never had to deal with before, and it's an increasing problem. Pollution, not just a local problem anymore, but some see it as really becoming a global issue. We now know that atmospheric pollution can travel across the globe from west to east. When you have a major volcanic eruption like Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines several years ago, that caused a massive cooling of the entire globe, especially the northern hemisphere, for years, because all that particulate gets up in the atmosphere, it gets circulated around, and it blocks some of the sunlight, and it cools things down for a good year or more. And we see the same effect with our own pollutants that we put into the air, water, trash in the oceans. There's a kind of an urban myth, or should I say a global myth, about this great plastic whirlpool up in the North Pacific that they say is just crowded with thrown away plastic bottles and plastic of almost any kind. Yeah, that technically does exist, but it's nowhere near as congested as some might lead you to believe. You often will see pictures of crowded caches of plastic that's in a harbor that's being pulled together, and it's that thick. Well, no, it's not. That's an extreme exaggeration. But we do get plastic that persists, and it remains in the area. It floats, and so if it's on the water and it's in the middle of the ocean, it's going to stay there a while. It's just, there's no place for it to go. We don't exactly send any kind of trawlers out to go clean up the plastic bottles from the surface of the ocean. And we have trash that's washing up on shore of South Pacific islands that are hundreds of miles off the shipping lanes. It's rare, but it happens, and you know, it's like, well, that's a problem. What do we do about that? The atmosphere, this whole idea of global warming, which we'll spend some time on at the end. They say the atmosphere's ability to regulate itself is being compromised by all the things we're putting into it. And so that's why they say with increased carbon dioxide, the atmosphere is warming, the Earth is warming, and that's something and it's probably going to increase not at a simple rate. The temperature, if it were just going like this, it wouldn't be a problem. But if the temperature rise is going to be more like that, well, then the time to do something about it would be way right here. By the time you get to there, it's too late. You won't be able to stop it, is what the concern is. Could there be a runaway warming, is what some people are concerned about. Human cultures that have learned to live in harmony with nature because of the urban sprawl, the agricultural increase, taking away natural lands for further use by humans. These people who live in harmony with nature know how to utilize the various plants and animals to their fullest effect in those areas. When their culture disappears, so does that knowledge. And so in the tropical areas where we do have rainforests and we have numerous small groups of peoples that have lived there for millennia and know how to live off the land very efficiently, as they become, especially young people, entranced by culture, modern technology, they don't want to stay in those areas, they want to leave the country area, they want to leave the tribal areas, and that knowledge eventually disappears. And that could be very helpful to the things we're searching for and looking for. Various types of medicines, various types of unique plants that they use for medicines of different types. It's been effective for millennia, they continue to use it. We lose some of that knowledge. So let me just ask this question. Why care about the environment? Whether you answer from your own perspective, what you think others might say, why do we even bother? Of course, I'm presuming you care, but maybe you don't. So, what would your parents say?
They wouldn't. No.
They would just shrug their shoulders? I don't know. Kind of like the vultures in Jungle Book? What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do?
I think my parents would probably say, you know, that like we care, but we don't care enough like go do something about it, you know.
Okay.
Or we would let other people do it, like, oh, there's people that are going to fix it, but we're...
So it's very much a back of the mind, kind of out of sight.
Out of mind.
Yeah, sort of thing, okay.
I think if you go to like a really extreme perspective and like caring about the environment would save us from like all of the whole like having to live in a bubble because we don't have any trees or anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that would be seen as a negative, having to live in a bubble.
Have y'all seen that TV show, Terranova?
That could be hazardous. But
oh, Wally!
Wally, yeah. We don't want to end up like that.
Okay, I mean, we don't want to just see like...
So it's just a, I don't know, back of the mind sort of thing, not really front burner. Probably feel a minuscule amount of guilt for not caring about it more, but not enough to change anything, right?
That would be ridiculous without, you know, a healthy environment, I think. You kind of need it to survive.
Kind of need it, okay. So basically we don't have a good answer to this question right now, do we? Well, hopefully I can correct that for you. Now, this comes from a book about the worldview crisis in Africa, and you don't have it in your outlines. You don't need to copy or anything like that. But I just wanted to show it to you that this is a universal concern among Christians. This person says, I'm worried about the ecological deterioration of our environment, again, coming from Kenya. The overgrazing, soil erosion are getting worse. Trees are cut down for firewood. Nobody plants anything to replace them. Would I be able to find guidelines in the Bible to motivate people towards conservation? Most people around here are Christians. I do know that the Lord gave the commands in Genesis that we have to be stewards of His creation in every sense of the word. I am, however, not merely looking for scattered texts, but am looking for a broad perspective with which I can inspire my students. Part of the reason why I teach an environmental science class, and part of the reason why this topic is a part of this class, he's asking a question which I asked, is there a biblical perspective, a broader perspective that can be helpful in inspiring people and guidelines to a degree, but we almost really have to change more about the way we think than what we actually do, and that'll come up here in a little bit. So, many people have actually blamed us, the Judeo-Christian worldview, for our ecological problems. And let me summarize, and we'll get more specific in a minute. Is the Bible to blame? They say Genesis says humans are to have rule and dominion over the earth. Now that sounds, and the actual language in Hebrew is of a warlike and a kingly sort of rule and dominion. That's how it's expressed. That's the type of word that's used here. So you could take this to mean that we have absolute control. So they extend it this way, and that some have interpreted that as a license to exploit, that we are able and actually supposed to use it as we choose. So they would suggest the solution is not new technology, but a new way of thinking about the environment. And in their mind, we need to trash this Christian way of thinking about it. So let's get a little more specific. Some of this comes from an article by Lynn White in 1967 in Science Magazine, one of the two main science journals in the world. Science is from the U.S., Nature is from Britain. And Francis Schaeffer used this article as a stepping-off point for his book, Pollution and the Death of Man, A Christian View of Ecology. And the basic presentation I'm going to give you is basically an outline of his book. So here's what some of the things he said in the articles. In referring to Christianity, God planned all of this explicitly for man's benefit and rule. No item in the physical creation had any purpose save to serve man's purposes. That even now sound accurate to you? So you're not sure if you agree or disagree with that. Yeah, I don't see much changing on people's faces. It says, Christianity, in absolute contrast to ancient paganism and Asia's religions, not only established a dualism of man and nature, but also insisted that it's God's will that man exploit nature for his, meaning man's, proper end. Sound a little harsh, sound accurate,
sounds like something I disagree with. I'm not sure why.
You don't like it. You don't like him to say that about Christianity. It's not a positive thing to say, is it?
Doesn't that kind of go against the whole Adam and Eve were supposed to take care of the garden and enter the garden and stuff like that? Or is that just...
Well, part of what people wonder is that does that just refer to the garden? Does that refer to the earth as a whole? Or just the garden?
That's kind of like the model of what we're supposed to act like, I guess.
Well, but we were kicked out of the garden.
Yeah, but that's, I guess, a model of a perfect situation in a perfect world.
Let's go on. He says, I personally doubt that disastrous ecological backlash can be avoided simply by applying our problems to our problems more science and more technology. So just the technology itself is not going to solve the problem. He says, what we do about ecology depends on our ideas of the man-nature relationship. And I agree with that. More science and technology are not going to get us out of the present ecological crisis until we find a new religion. Now, what he means there, he doesn't mean just invent something completely new, but we need to change the way we think about the natural world. And the way Christianity has taught us to think about the natural world has gotten us into this problem. So we need something to replace that. Whatever that is, was basically his point. What he essentially wants to go back to is a more pagan idea where there were like sacred groves of trees where he just left them alone and they were allowed to do what they do. And so go back to a more pagan where the reason we did that, though, was because humans feared what would happen to them if we mess with the sacred groves of trees and we'll be punished for it. And that's not exactly the right attitude to have either. Okay, so let's look at a couple of other views, the other worldviews we've discussed before. With naturalism, as we've discussed, the ultimate value for humans is our survival, not just of the individual, but human survival as a species. So if that's the ultimate value for us, we would perhaps reason that we're not going to survive well without a healthy planet. That makes sense. That's essentially what Nick said earlier. For us to enjoy our lives the way we think we're meant to enjoy them, to have parks and national parks and wilderness areas and all that, you know, that's, we like those things. And to a degree, you could argue, according to ecological principles, that preserving some of those areas helps the planet as a whole. And there's a balance involved. One of the things you learn in ecology is everything is interconnected with everything else. And you disrupt one part of it, and it's going to have ripple effects that dampen down the further away you get. But you create enough areas where there's big ripples, well, you've got problems all around. So, yeah, we need a healthy planet. So we should preserve our planet in order to rescue our future. And oftentimes, politically particularly, what you will hear from people is that we need to interfere, we need to preserve for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, to at least be able to enjoy the Earth and the planet as we have been able to enjoy it. But the trend is that things are going to just get worse and worse and worse. I can tell you that from the time I was a student, our air and water is far cleaner than it was then. We've enacted certain kinds of, we've talked about them in the environmental science class. There was a Clean Water Act, there was a Clean Air Act from the 70s, particularly the early 70s, that put into motion regulations that allowed us to clean up our air and water to agree that it wasn't. You still hear a little bit about the smog of Los Angeles, but trust me, in the 70s and 80s, it was far worse than it is today. So everything is a little bit better, quite a bit better actually, than it was just a few decades ago. So we're kind of reversing some of those things. But one of the things you also learn is that the only reason we've been able to do that is because we are a prosperous society and we have excess cash to devote to doing those kinds of things. Because that required changes in the gasoline we burn, changes in how engines were constructed to burn gasoline. It required changes to the smokestacks of power plants that burn coal to take some of the pollutants out of the smoke before it gets into the atmosphere. We're doing a lot more things that are expensive that we just never thought of doing before to clean up the air and the water in ways that we didn't even think of before. But we can do that because we can afford to do it. You get to a developing nation, they're trying to survive. They don't have the prosperity that we do to enact some of these changes. But the problem here mainly is that this becomes ultimately selfish. And I say that because it really comes down to what we as humans need. What do we want? Only had one taker in the previous class, but anybody here a watcher of Star Trek at all?
Wait, which? The old ones or the...
Any of them. So some Star Trek, okay. When they want to take a vacation, what do? You ever see an episode dealing with that? On the Starship Enterprise. Need a vacation. Go to a place they call the holodeck. Virtual reality. Put on your glasses, type into the system where you want to go for your vacation, and virtually you go to a different place. You know how they get their food? They have this little sliding window, and you type in what you want. It simply rearranges molecules and creates your meal. They don't grow anything. They don't store anything. What do you need nature for now? You're totally self-sustained on the Starship Enterprise. If you don't really need it for anything, what's the value of nature back on Earth now? Not a lot. If you don't really need it for anything, well, it suddenly loses its value. So that's kind of risky, if that's the direction, if that's the foundation you want to use. Pantheism also has its issues. As we've talked about here, all is one, all is God. Nature is respected. Why? Because it's a part of God's essence. It's a part of the One. Therefore, we act to save our planet because it has equal value with us. But does it really end up working out that way? Well, you do end up with a bit of a problem here, because it will ultimately degrade us as well as degrade nature. Example I frequently use is when you go to Hindu India and some of their villages, they have literally millions and millions of different gods, and every village has their own pantheon that they worship. It doesn't seem right, since it is pantheistic, why they have gods, but sometimes it's monkeys. I think, wasn't it a village of monkeys in one of the Indiana Jones movies that got them in trouble to start with, where things began? monkeys were worshipped, and they were put out food for them and all that sort of thing. Well, you know, in villages like that, whether it's monkeys or cows or rats, you don't interfere with them. So cows can walk through your village, in and out of your house, and just do what cows do, is they're roaming around, which is kind of smelly and gross. And if the rats start eating your food, no big deal. Just leave them alone. The species that ends up having to sacrifice the most ends up being humans. All other species are just allowed to be and do what they are. Humans, for some reason, have to change. Why is that? That doesn't make any sense at all. So a couple of things end up happening as well. The individual things don't really have any meaning, because if everything is the same, there are no distinctions, and how can you assign any value to anything in particular? And also, therefore, there's no real reason for environmental action. If all is one and all is God, then what we see is just what is. It's neither good, it's neither bad, there's no right or wrong, everything is relative, so why change anything? Why preserve a tiger's habitat? Especially when you have to remove whole villages of people sometimes to accomplish that. That doesn't make any sense in a pantheistic worldview. So it ends up being something you really can't follow very well. You have no answer for benevolent and destructive forces of nature. There's no distinction between them. They're all the same. A hurricane is the same as a sunny, breezy day on the seashore. It's just nature doing what nature does. It's neither good nor evil. It just is. So you get some problems here. One additional phrase to that last quote that I used from Lynn White. Until we find a new religion or rethink our old one. And what I'm going to contend, and what Francis Schaeffer contends, is that Lynn White has misread what the Scriptures have to say, and we do need to rethink what the Scriptures say about our interaction with the environment. So what I say is the answer lies in a true Christian environmental ethic, and there's the title of Schaeffer's book, Pollution and the Death of Man, A Christian View of Ecology. And this the rest of this presentation now is essentially an outline of his book. I stole it entirely. So first of all, we start with God. God is the creator. God is not a small g. There actually is a God. He's the creator. So all of nature is equal in its origin because it at one point it wasn't, and then it was. And it's purely an act of God. Nature, therefore, has value simply because God created it. There's an intrinsic value to nature. It's not that we need it. It's valuable because God made it. And that's all that it needs to have value. So in a sense, you can draw a couple lines here to separate God from the rest of creation. That on one hand, we are equal with everything else because we are all products of the Creator. But while man is a creature, he is also created in God's image. Genesis 1, Psalm 139, we were fearfully and wonderfully made. That enters a slightly different perspective. Here you can put a couple lines of separation, God and man on one side, and the rest of creation on the other. We are the only species that is created in God's image. And I would maintain that our physical, biological body is the only organismal body that's capable of expressing the image of God. Jesus did not come as a chimpanzee. The chimpanzee frame and brain and other physiological traits are not capable of expressing the image of God. Ours is. So there is a uniqueness in the sense of our physical body, not that we look like God, but that our body is fully capable of housing God's image, whereas anything else that God has made is not. Animals glorify the Creator as they are. Everybody likes the little kitten. It's nice and cute. Puppies are cute. They grow so fast. Yeah, our dog Baylor is about a 60-pound golden retriever, and he still thinks he's a 10-pound puppy. Goldens tend to be like that. Very fun-loving, very energetic. He's 4, almost 5. So, but what I mean by romanticize is that, yeah, Baylor is a part of our family, but he's a dog. Our previous golden retriever, Calvin, was 7 when he developed an inoperable tumor. And about a year and a half ago, or no, back in April, not even a year ago now. And when we did the exploratory surgery, we just, okay, it's inoperable, just don't even wake him up. Trying to recover from surgery with the difficulty he's already having just didn't make any sense. But if grandma's on the operating table and they discover an inoperable tumor, they don't just close her up and don't wake her up. Because she's made in the image of God, and we'll do that with an animal, but we won't do that with human beings, because there is a distinction. And ours is the only worldview that makes that kind of distinction. Everything else you look at, any other major world religion, cults that come from Christianity do that, but that's because they're coming, their base is Christianity. Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, they're connected in that similar way, so they have the same perspective, but it's unique to Christian-related religions, Christ-related religions. Man's been given dominion over nature, and our task is to find out what does that really mean. What does dominion mean? It doesn't mean that we're sovereign. Nature doesn't belong to us. It belongs to God. And sometimes I think we've been guilty of treating it as if it is ours. Just because we own a piece of property, I don't think that gives us the right to do with it whatever we want. We were told to cultivate and keep the garden, so we were given work to do before the fall. I think that's significant in and of itself. Work is not a result of the fall. Work got harder as a result of the fall. So we do use it, but only as God intends. And I mentioned the parable from Matthew 25, which is the parable of the talents, where the master gave three stewards different amounts of money, the talents, and left for a period of time. When he came back, he asked for an accounting. The one he gave five to had doubled it. Well done, good and faithful servant. The one I think he gave two talents to, he doubled it as well. Well done, good and faithful servant. But the one that the steward he gave one talent to, what had that steward done with it?
Buried it.
Why? Didn't want to lose it, but he was also afraid because his master had harsh terms. So rather than risk losing it, he just buried it. When the master returned, he just gave it back to him. Well, what was the master's response to that? He was not happy, was he? Not happy at all. So if the earth, you could say, is our talent that we've been given as a steward, when Jesus returns, will we give it back in better or worse shape than what we got it in? I don't think it's in such good shape. We have the capability, being made in God's image, to add beauty. And you can make the point that some of the ways we construct buildings, our homes, are adding a certain type of beauty, a creative type of beauty that wasn't here before. So we, in some ways, we have added to it. But I would say more often than not, it's a negative balance, not a positive one, in terms of how we've interacted with things. So essentially, dominion does mean stewardship. And the author of the environmental text that I use is a evangelical believer. I still don't always agree with all of his perspectives. But I think his writing is going to be a bit safer than somebody who's not. The source of this crisis, if we're having one indeed, is man's fallen nature. We are now sinful. We do look out for ourselves, and we haven't been effective stewards. And you could say that we've used the dominion we've been granted incorrectly. Wrongly might not be a great term for it. And you could make the argument that we have exploited created things. I asked in the last class, have any of you ever traveled on Interstate 40 and just gone west of Amarillo? 40 primarily cuts through Oklahoma and northern Arkansas, and then it heads into the panhandle of Texas, goes through Amarillo, and you get to the other side of Amarillo, and you don't get ranches like you see here, you get feedlots. Where the cattle are just highly concentrated, they're fed grain, and you know they don't eat hay or grass or anything like that, but it's to raise the most amount of cattle in as little a space as possible. And the stench permeates everything. It's like, I can't get through western Amarillo fast enough. Let's speed a little bit if we have to, because it permeates the closed windows. I don't care if you put the air conditioning on closed vents, everything, it's still going to get in. And for quite a few years now, I found out how veal is made. You know what veal is? It's meat from a calf. And in order to get tender veal, you can't allow the calf to exercise. They get basically hemmed into a box where they stand all the time, and they all do is not, they do anything but eat, drink, defecate, urinate. That's it. That's how you get veal. I don't think that's creating God, treating God's creatures as they were meant to be created. I choose not to eat veal because of that. It's a personal decision on my part. There's no biblical mandate to not eat. It's not there, but it's just my personal decision. And I think that's an exploitation of created things. And particularly, you know, they are mammals. They are thinking organisms, more so than birds would be or anything like that, more so than chickens. So beef, sheep, cattle, sheep, even pigs ought to be treated a little bit differently than we treat them currently as we raise these things for our purposes. But part of the pressure that we feel is that societies, as they become more technologically oriented, they become less dependent upon grains for food, and they want meat. Meat is what people in Western societies tend to prefer more of. When I travel to places like Liberia and even Belarus, meat's a pretty small part of the diet compared to here. They just can't afford it. So, we have a fallen nature, and it expressed itself oftentimes in the use of time and money. What Francis Schaeffer refers to is what he calls our uncontrolled greed and haste. Now, if you think about how a normal housing development is constructed, we just witnessed this down Custer Road here a little bit when you get to that Plano farm property where they apparently sold a pretty large tract of it, and it's being made into a housing development. And essentially what they do is they just clear it and bulldoze it and start from scratch. Whatever trees were there are gone, whatever bushes, you know, all that stuff just goes away. And then they start adding in the homes, and more so than even before, our homes are built pretty close together. That's to increase the profit per acre of land. The more homes you get on an acre of land, the more money you will make. And you bulldoze everything down because that's the quickest way to get it done. If you had to build around a couple of 200-year-old trees or something like that, well, that just increases the time commitment, it increases the cost, and usually the choice is to avoid that. So the greed and haste comes into play with that kind of decision, because we want to get it done, we want to make the most amount of money in the shortest amount of time we can. Concerns about the land itself just don't seem to come up much in those decisions. So if we can do it, that's the way we will do it, especially if there's a time and economic benefit to doing it that particular way. And that actually applies to genetic technology. Yeah, we can. Why wouldn't we? The solution then, I believe, is the witness overall of the Christian community in the proper relationship between God, man, and nature. Now, in your Christian circles to this point, have you ever had any conversations about the environment? Probably not. That's usually what I expect. We have to inspect a little bit, what does it mean to exercise rightful dominion? Well, as I like to say, the leaders of any environmental movement then should be those who claim at least to be rightly related to the Creator. Well, that's us. But you go inside our churches and you find little to nothing as far as discussion about environmental issues. We should treat nature as having inherent value because it is His creation. It's not ours. We've just been given stewardship over it. We need to work at exercising that dominion without being unnecessarily destructive. It's easy to go in that direction and just do things the way we want to do them because it suits us. This, however, ends up requiring both a human and an economic cost. By human cost, I mean it takes more effort, it takes more time. And yeah, there will be. It will cost more. If you're going to build a housing development that takes full advantage of the aesthetics of the land that you're building on, yeah, there's going to be a cost to that in a lot of different ways, but it will also end up providing a far more aesthetically pleasing development. Even in the Old Testament, there are some very strict provisions. Leviticus 25 is a series of commands about how the Israelites were to take care of the land. One of those very specific provisions given was that you were to plant your crops for 6 years, and then on the seventh year, give the land a year of rest. Very sound agricultural environmental practice to rest a portion of your land every 7 years. It was promised that in the sixth year you would have a bountiful harvest so that you'd have enough to last through that seventh year without having to plant and harvest more crop. But the Babylonian captivity was how long? Remember? The specific number of years. 70. 70 years. Do you know why it was 70 years?
7 is the perfect number.
No. Nation of Israel had missed 7 years of Sabbath rest for the land. 70 Sabbaths. Land rest were ignored. So what God said, okay, you're not. I'm going to take you out of the land so it gets its 70 years of rest. That tells you that that year of rest for the land was significant in God's perspective. It wasn't a add-on command. It was something very important. So that 70 years of captivity was because they skipped 70 years of Sabbath rests for the nation of Israel. There are certain instructions in the law about how to treat your domesticated animals as well as how to treat wildlife with respect. That Deuteronomy 22:6 passage simply talks about if you're walking along the road and you come across a bird laying on its nest with eggs, you're allowed to take the eggs for food, but do not take both the eggs and the bird, the female laying on the eggs. Why? Why just the egg? Why, if you're hungry, I mean, why not take them both?
Will not continue on. Like, if you take the bird, it's not going to continue making eggs.
If you take just the egg, what's the bird going to do?
It's going to make more
eggs. It's going to lay more eggs. That's how they operate. When the nest is gone, there's no more eggs, the birds lay more eggs. But if you take both the bird and the eggs, well, you stop the cycle of life. So here was a clear instruction that was a very sound ecological principle, even in the Old Testament. There was a judgment proclaimed in Isaiah chapter 5 against those who misused the land. And what that was about, what God complained about, was in Judah particularly building, as it says, house upon house, so there was no room for anything else in their cities and their land. That's a pretty good description of the way we build houses. House upon house. You got enough room for your small yard space, but not much beyond that. Okay. Baylor much more enjoys chasing the ball when we're out in an open field, when he can just run and go, but rather than in the backyard where he has to literally put the brakes on before he runs into the fence. Sometimes I think he's actually trying to beat the ball to the fence. He runs so hard, that, but then he has to... really break hard. He always manages to stop. He hasn't crashed into the fence yet, but I don't know. There's a path being worn where the grass is just kind of flying, so I have to manipulate where I throw the ball. The Lord cares for His creation. Psalm 104 is a creation psalm, and verses 27 to 30 really are about how the God takes care of the animals. He feeds them, takes care of the plants, He waters everything. It indicates that God is actively caring for His creation, and if we are His stewards in doing so, then we ought to as well. A couple of those verses talk about that God created the mountain goat, the mountains for the mountain goats, and the crags, if you will, in the mountains for the conies, or like rabbits, if you will, or pikas in the mountains. And what that indicates is that God created certain environments specifically for certain kinds of animals. So our practice today, which only came about in the early 20th century with President Theodore Roosevelt, of setting aside land for national parks to remain as they are, it's a very biblical principle. We're preserving land that God created specifically for the kinds of creatures who live in that kind of land. So I have full support of that sort of context. Sometimes we can overextend that. I think it's a major portion of the North Slope of Alaska that Obama and the EPA is considering turning into a national wildlife refuge, which would completely inhibit any oil exploration. If it's a national wilderness area, you can't touch it with anything. Not sure that we need to go to that extent. The oil drilling that is being done in the Arctic off the coast, north coast of Alaska, has been very respectful environmentally. We've done a good job with that. It seems that we could continue to do so, and perhaps even do so in a more efficient manner as we learn more. So those are where some of the tensions come in. How do we use some of these biblical principles when we're looking at very real life decisions about certain places? The first Adam, we know, brought a curse on his relationship with God, other people, and even nature. The effects of the curse because of Adam's sin was, you know, you'll by the sweat of your brow you will eat your bread, the land will bring forth thorns and thistles. In other words, the work you were already doing in the garden, which was so fulfilling, is now going to be really hard. I mean, just really hard. And nature was affected as a part of the curse from the fall. But the second Adam, as we're told, I won't go into these verses here necessarily, but the second Adam redeems all of the effects of the curse, and in some respects then we are his instruments of bringing about this redemption, not just in the lives of other humans, but in nature itself. So the first thing you come to is that as believers, we really ought not to be the chief destroyers. But sometimes we can be seen as being at the top of the list, because we don't seem to express any level of care or concern. Trees should not be cut down without justifiable cause. If all you're saying is that, well, I just don't like this tree. Okay, fine, but if you're going to cut it down, are you going to replace it with something? There is a company out of, I think it's Nebraska. It's called National Arbor Day, and there is a National Arbor Day, by the way. It's in April, usually. And it's seen as a day for everyone to plant a tree. Usually for about $10, I did this a couple of times with National Arbor Day, they will send you very young seedlings of a certain types of trees. They will send you what we have here, the crepe myrtle, which is the one that grows and gets all the nice pinkish flowers. And it's good in this part of the country. The Bradford pear, which blossoms really nicely. Why is that name escaping me? We got one in our yard. The purple flowers. Oh well, I'll think of it somewhere along the line. But you could get, and they're only about this long, and the root, the little root, is contained in a plastic bag, and it's moist. And I just planted them in pots to start with and let them grow and get green. And in our previous house, when we lived in Garland, I ended up planting several of those, and there's new trees. And they're flowering trees, and that I like that. So there are ways that you can beautify an area without having to spend a lot of money. If I were to buy those trees as not just seedlings, but fully grown, rather small sapling types, you're spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars for somebody to have spent years growing those trees for you. And you have to carve out a huge big hole because they come with a root ball and you just plop the whole thing in there. And yeah, that's really expensive. But there are cheap ways to do it if you want to, if you're patient. And they just send them to you pretty cheap. I think they just ask for a donation, so it's, you're not even technically being charged for it. You make a donation to Arbor Day and they send you trees in the mail. Now, it's not seeds, but actual little bitty trees. We think about these kinds of decisions before just changing everything. We can rid our house of ants. We have a pest control service. They come by quarterly. And when we first moved into our house in South Garland, back in 84, we had a major roach problem. We'd had roach problems in our apartments that we'd lived in. So we didn't want that. So we employed a pest control company. And it's safe for pets, and you know, we had a dog for many of those years, so it's not as big a problem as you might think. A lot of these pest control companies are aware of the environmental issues. They use pesticides that are short-lived. That's why they have to come back repeatedly. And that's intentional, so that things don't persist longer than necessary. And so, yeah, we can rid our house of the pests that tend to infest. I've had to rid our current house outside of rats. We've had rats out there. Our whole neighborhood had a problem with rats for quite a while. It was a long battle. It was not fun. They were eating my birdseed. They'd crawl up the pole.
That's why he was very offended.
I had to start putting Vaseline on the pole. Yeah. But then in the summer, the Vaseline continually melts off, and you have to keep putting it back on. So, and what would happen is if one would get up there, then it would throw seed down. It would just take its snout and do this. Throw it down the ground.
Did you just watch that happen?
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah.
Wait, so what's
what's his face?
So, like, that's like
100% valid. Like,
legitimately, yeah! I thought he was just, like, improved, but he's actually... his name!
Yes. Ratatouille? No, that's the baker mouse, right?
Yeah.
or rat.
Right there.
Okay. But when we come across even these pesky things where God created them to be, we leave them alone. You know, there are, if you go to the, there's an Audubon station in South Dallas along the Trinity River near where Loop 12 crosses Interstate 45. And I've taken my environmental science class there last year. And you can come across some fire ant mounds. But they don't do anything to get rid of those there. They're an invasive species, but so we came across a few, and just to make sure those were live mounds, you just kick it. And yeah, you know real quick that it's a live fire ant mound, and you just watch them all scatter. Yeah. Back when before we were renting a house in the early 80s, they didn't have all, they were, fire ants were fairly new, and we had them in our backyard. We had young boys. So the only way I could get rid of them was to go back in the area and like I said, stir up so that they would all start coming up, and I would just spray with a normal Raid and kill them, and keep going back to do that about every day. And you eventually get it, but you've got to be really persistent. But adding that much Raid to my backyard probably wasn't the best solution in the long term, but It was the only thing I had to keep my kids from getting bit up. If we react this way and interact with the environment this way, I think it restores our sense of humanity and our sense of beauty. We tend to lose sight of that. We tend to look too much to our personal comfort than experiencing our humanity and the beauty of God's nature and His creation. I haven't been back to the Grand Canyon now probably in about 7 or 8 years, and I miss it. To me, it's one of the most beautiful places on earth. I've hiked the Grand Canyon numerous times, from the rim down to the river and back out again. I've led trips there, backpacking. The last one guy almost didn't make it out, and that could be why it was the last one I've done. Well, let's just say that on the previous day's hike, because we had our camp that we stayed in for 3 days, was about two-thirds of the way down, but there's a little creek that runs down there all year long. One of the few places in the Grand Canyon where you have fresh water coming all year, even in the summer. You still have to filter your water and treat it to drink it, but we made a hike down to the river, where it gets hotter. When you go down in the canyon, it gets hotter. It can be 70 degrees on the rim, but it's 95 or 100 at the river on the same day. So going down the river means it's going to be hot, and we were able to water up a little bit using the river water, which you have to be careful of because there's more grit in that, and you have to use a paper filter first to get the grit out, and then you get the critters out with the other kind of stuff. Well, on the hike back out, it's still hot to get back to our camp by dinner time, and your nice cold river water warms up. And these guys had spent time backpacking in the Rockies and the mountains, and were used to all their water being cold. And this one guy, who was the youngest of three brothers who were on the trip, and he was also the least in shape. He carried more extra weight than I was happy with. And he just couldn't drink that hot water on that previous day. So he got real dehydrated the first day. He spent, when we got back, he never got off his back, and he was in his tent the entire time. Open air, but laying down. And I asked, "How you doing?" "Okay, I'm fine, I'll be all right." Well, we're about 1,000 feet below the rim. We have probably about another 3 hours of hiking to get completely out of the canyon. And myself and another guy, we got into this area where I said, "Okay, we'll all stop here. We'll meet and we'll rest. It's nice shade, and we'll go out together. I'll be the last one from that point. And in case anybody has trouble, I'll be there to wait and help and do whatever." So this other fellow, younger guy, and I both got there at the same time, and we're waiting, enjoying, relaxing. And I hear from about, I don't know, 50 to 100 feet below where we're at, what I'll just call the dry heaves. Somebody was throwing up, but you could tell it was not productive. And I, oh man, if that's one of our guys. And it was. So he had to put his pack down on the trail right there. He couldn't carry his pack any further. So somebody else, he put it down. They got up to where he could rest and where we were at. And we realized, okay, he can't carry his pack out of the canyon. So he went up without it. One of the young guys, who was a son of one of those three brothers, he went first and got all the way out of the canyon. And then came back down to that spot where I waited for him. And he picked up the... I didn't wait for him, but he came back down and he got the pack and got rid of his, came down and got that one. He brought it a third of the way up. One of the other guys brought it the next third of the way, and I brought it the last third of the way up. But carrying his own pack, he wouldn't have gotten out of the canyon. So, yeah, I haven't had a backpacking trip in the canyon since then. But that's where my sense of humanity and beauty is restored in a lot of different ways. And I think the church has really fallen on its face with this one. You never hear of a church-sponsored environmental group. At least in the churches I've been involved in, I've spoken on this at our church, Watermark. I've even complained about the thousands of styrofoam cups that are used every Sunday morning for coffee. Styrofoam is not reusable. It's reusable only as packing material. It's the only thing you can do with styrofoam. And it persists in landfills for much longer than decades. It just doesn't degrade. It's a plastic, and it just doesn't degrade. But it's a nice insulating cup because you can hold really hot stuff, and you just barely get warm. Anything else that's disposable, you're going to have to be a little more careful with it. A little more expensive, but I choose not. We don't have styrofoam cups in our home. In a sense, we're losing evangelistic opportunity because lots of young people do have environmental concerns, and when they sense that the church doesn't have not even any interest in it, that turns people away. And that's unfortunate. It doesn't have to be like that. I'm not saying profit is wrong. That's the foundation of a capitalistic system. But at the same time, we may need to accept some limits to that and not use such levels of greed and haste, as Schaefer refers to it, and whatever our endeavors are, and be willing to have a little bit more patience and create something with a little more aesthetic beauty and concern for the environment as a whole. So if we can treat with integrity the things God has made, I believe that change will come. That's idealistic. Very idealistic. But you know, we live in situations now where most of our municipalities will ask you to separate your normal garbage from your recyclables. So your newspaper, your plastic bottles, your glass. And the city pays to separate all those things. And, you know, a lot of that stuff definitely is recycled. Our recycling gets picked up every other week, and it's always far more full than the garbage can is. And that gets picked up every week. I think, you know, which I don't need my garbage picked up every week. I can't fill that can, even in 2 weeks. But the recyclable is almost brimming over sometimes. And if we miss a recyclable day, we forget to put it out, oh, we're in trouble. Because we don't have any place to put it. Suddenly all the cans have to be squished, take them out of there to make room, and you know, all kinds of things have to happen. So it's a problem. Now, we're going to close with this little section on global warming. And this is a major environmental issue and controversy today. And it is a major political hot potato, if you will. The two different sides of this argument are highly polarized and really struggle to find any common ground. And as a Christian, I hesitated to even look into this very much for quite some time. I've been aware of it for a long time. It began being talked about in about the early to mid-90s. But as a Christian and a scientific background, I hesitated to get involved with it simply because if the data seem to say that the Earth is not warming as much as they say it is, then Christians already tend to have a reputation for being anti-scientific. And I didn't want to unnecessarily add to that. So I took my time. I was reading stuff from both sides of the argument. And what you're going to see here is what my overall conclusion about this is, where I still stand today. Is the Earth warming? Well, yes. That's kind of the simple answer to that question. Nobody really disputes that. But we do have periods where the Earth has warmed and cooled for a very long time. We do have a record from the rocks from ancient times where the Earth was far warmer than it is today, far more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than there was today, and even more recently. But since 1900, the Earth has definitely warmed by about a half a degree Celsius or 1 degree Fahrenheit. Doesn't sound like a lot. But what I point out for you over here is that if the temperature increase was just that straight line, then it was just increasing steadily, not a problem. What they're suspecting is that there will be an exponential increase eventually. And if you wait till you're in the exponential temperature rise, well, it's too late. You're not going to be able to change anything. Whereas the first X is where what they're saying, this is where we are now. So if we institute some real changes, we can have an effect on this and be prepared far better than we are currently. That's the argument. It's an increase in what they call greenhouse gases, specifically carbon dioxide has been ruled the culprit. That has definitely been increasing in our atmosphere. It's about 1.5 times what it was in 1900. So it's increased about 40-50%. And I'll give you some specific figures on that in a little bit. And we can document some of that to a wide extent with some good confidence. This is a graph that really was done in 1998, about 1999. And this is referred to often as the hockey stick, because it's shaped like a hockey stick. It's a long handle and a sharp upturn at the end. And the implication is, starting in the year AD 1000, overall temperature didn't change much. Now, notice on the y-axis, you've got 0.0, then minus 0.5. So there wasn't even a change of a quarter of a degree from 100 to about 1900. But then suddenly things changed dramatically in the late 19th century. And through the 20th century, to get up to that point, 1998, a huge increase in a short period of time compared to the steady, slow, almost imperceptible decrease. The man et al. Published this in 1999, and he is a major proponent of human-caused global warming, that's what's happening, and we need to find a way to stop it. But this graph has been shown to be completely false, that it doesn't represent the historical data at all, and it even misrepresents the amount of change that's taken place since 1900. This graph is a bit more accurate. It shows you this almost the same time period, but what you see is a temperature in what they call the medieval warming period, where it was actually warmer than it is today. Part of the reason they can document that is not that they actually have temperature readings, but in Europe particularly, where most of our civilization was at that time, in that medieval warm period, first of all, that's when Greenland was colonized, and it's why they called it Greenland. You could actually grow crops. They had permanent settlements in Greenland, which they don't have today. You can't survive in Greenland today. You can't grow crops because the summer doesn't last long enough. It's not warm enough. So all you have are ruins of Scandinavian settlements in Greenland. Also, in that period of time, we had vineyards in southern England. You can't grow any grapes for wine in England today because it's not warm enough, and you haven't been able to for hundreds of years. So there are very real indications that temperatures were warmer in that medieval time. Then there's also something they call the Little Ice Age, where temperatures cooled off. And one of the comments made about that is that for a limited period of time during that 1700s, mostly the 16, 1700s, you could ice skate on the Thames River in London. It completely froze over. Never happens today. So in a sense, what they're saying, well, we're still warming up from the Little Ice Age. And the book I got this graph from is basically, the title of it is Unstoppable Global Warming Every 1500 Years. So there's a recurring pattern of warming and cooling, and we really don't understand fully what's behind that level of warming and cooling. Now, carbon dioxide levels have increased. They've come from about 315 in 1958 to 385 in 2008. At around 1900, I think the figure they give is 285. Now it's over 400. But that's parts per million, which is really just 4 parts per 10,000 air molecules. Not exactly a lot of carbon dioxide. It's not a major component of the atmosphere. It is something that's needed. Plants require carbon dioxide. That's why vegetation has increased globally between 82 and 99. Carbon dioxide basically is a fertilizer for plants. Greenhouses routinely, artificially increase the concentration of carbon dioxide so the plants will grow better. So a little extra carbon dioxide is not such a bad thing. We've always known that plants grow better with excess carbon dioxide. It will increase food production, and that can lead to famines and floods. Some weather patterns might change, but probably not significantly. The sunspot activity, sunspots change in a regular 11-year cycle, and those 11-year cycles also have their minimums, their highs. When there's lots of sunspots, the sun is radiating more heat. Fewer sunspots, less heat. What the indication is that we're entering a period where sunspots are going to be decreased, and they think it'll be an extended period of time. So the people who think that sunspot activity is more tied to the warming than anything else are expecting a cooling to come along fairly soon. And also, when you look at the actual temperature data, the warming has actually stagnated. This is a graph. Goes back to 79 when they started measuring the temperature of the atmosphere. So this is satellite temperatures. And what you see is a great peak there in 98 due to a strong El Nino. And then since that time, after things settled down a bit, there's really been no warming. And there actually hasn't been any increased warming for now. That was 2013. We've gone another year. It's basically about 15 years now with no global warming. And even the global warming enthusiasts have had to admit that things have stalled. Even though carbon dioxide has continued its rate of increase, but the warming has stalled. And if carbon dioxide is the cause of the warming, that doesn't make sense. That shouldn't be happening. We shouldn't have had this kind of stall. By the way, there refers to the Mount Pinatubo cooling there back in 93. So things cooled by 3/10 of a degree centigrade for about a year or so. People have claimed to be more intense hurricanes. Well, the last two hurricane seasons predicted to be more intense than 2005 of Katrina and Rita fame both fizzled. Hurricane intensity is due primarily to the temperature difference between water and the air. When the water is, that's why it's in the fall, the water is warmer than the air is, and so that moist air rises, and that's what creates the swirling tropical depressions.
Same thing with tornadoes.
Yeah, same thing with tornadoes. But if the temperature of the air and the temperature of the oceans are both increasing, well, the difference between the air and the water is not changing. So why would there be more intense hurricanes? It doesn't make scientific sense. Meteorologists particularly don't like that particular claim. And most people, most scientists are able to state fairly clearly that you're not going to be able to tie any particular natural event to global warming. We really can't do that. But yet the media does it routinely all the time. Species extinction, some predict up to 20% will go extinct. But most, if not all, of our current species have survived numerous global coolings and warmings over the last million years, if you have that perspective, even just the last 2,000 years. The medieval warming period, the Little Ice Age, things got warmer, things got cooler. The species we have today survived all that just fine. The other thing is that species are far more sensitive to cold than they are to increasing heat. Our winters kill far more people around the world than summers ever do. That's just a fact. Even as humans, we're far more sensitive to increased cold than we are to heat. Sea levels, well, they've been rising for probably thousands of years since the Ice Age. That's continued. The rate has not increased.
How old do you think the Earth is?
Oh, that's a later talk. That's a long answer. The oceans have risen since Roman times, since the time of Christ, by almost 3 feet. Well before there was any increase in carbon dioxide. So this has been going on for a very long time. And there, we cannot measure any increase in the rate that the oceans are rising. Yes, there are glaciers that are retreating. If you take an Alaskan cruise, the Mendenhall Glacier has retreated several miles that you can see. But there are other glaciers in the world that are growing. They're getting longer. Some of the reason that the glaciers are retreating is because of our pollution, which puts soot into the air, which then settles on the ice, which increases the rate at which the ice absorbs heat from the sun. You put dark particles on the ice, then it's going to absorb heat better than if it's just ice. So that's another reason why they're decreasing inside, not because of the warming, but because their actual surface is warming because of particles. Many we can measure had retreated even further during the medieval warming. So a couple of summary things here. I'm skeptical of the role of carbon dioxide. Can be beneficial. Too much faith in the computer models. Restrictions of fossil fuels, I believe, are more designed to regulate the economy than save the planet. Extreme environmentalists put the planet first and humans a distant second. And that's a very different worldview perspective. The naturalistic worldview is not going to work here, as we've already pointed out. There's something that was called the Kyoto Protocol back in 91. The U.S. Senate declined to participate by a vote of 90-1. Okay? That was during the Clinton administration. They declined to be a part of it. Al Gore, Mr. Environmentalist, was vice president, and no, the Senate didn't go along with it at all. But even if we followed it, they would have admitted that it would reduce global temperatures by 0.13 degrees Fahrenheit. And it would cost huge amounts of money to do that. Rising fuel prices will most likely affect the poor. If electricity costs more, is that going to affect the rich very much? No, when gas prices go up, the rich keep buying whatever they want. They don't care. It doesn't matter. It's gotten cheaper. It's more affordable. But, you know, we always pay lower prices than what they do in the rest of the world. We just do. Stabilized greenhouse gases at current levels would require a reduction of 60% of carbon dioxide output from what we were producing in 1990. I don't see us getting anywhere close to that. Our energy consumption has continued to increase. Technology aids and abets that tremendously. Just think how when the only phone you had was the phone plugged into the wall. And
do you guys even remember that?
No, I don't.
Yeah, you don't have any idea about that. Computers didn't exist. Computers are a major source of electricity drain. So yeah, trying to go back to 1990 levels, renewable energy, wind energy, solar energy just is not going to get us there. It's just not going to get us there. It's far too expensive. And again, it's the perspective that people don't really matter that much. So that's it. Questions? Comments? Sarcasm?